This episode of the podcast is brought to you by my company, Horns of Odin. Now, with this week, we've got a really exciting announcement, and that is that on the 4th of December, we're going to be releasing the biggest ever clothing collection that we've ever done. The winter range is going to comprise of last year's winter jacket, we brought back in a brand new colour and added a really warm fleece lining to the inside. We've also got an amazing fisherman sweater. Alongside that, we've got a selection of t-shirts. They're all going to have a petroglyph style design. So we're going to have Odin riding Sleipnir. We're going to have Thor with his goats. We've got Frey and his boar. We've also got Freya and her cats. So for those that like things a little bit more simple, we're going to have a couple of t-shirts that are going to have a petroglyph style version of our logo on there. We've also got a selection of hats and scarves. So whatever you do, just check out the website on the 4th of December and you're going to see some amazing new products. And don't forget, the listeners of the podcast get an extra 10% off anything store-wide with the code HORNS10. So that's the code HORNS10, which will get you 10% off everything store-wide, including the new range. Hello and welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farren, co-owner of the company Horns of Odin, and I'm joined, as always, by Dr. Matthias Nordvig.
Hello, everyone. We're joined by Josh Rudd, who this is not the first time we've had Josh Rudd on the podcast. Just to recap who he is, Josh is our resident lead singer of the Icelandic black metal band Nexion. He's also a PhD student at the University of Iceland, where he's researching modern applications of Nordic mythology in Ásatrú, Scandinavian neo-paganism. And aside from that, Josh, you have also recently been roped into working with Jonas Lorentzen on his Nibala music project. So welcome to the show, and please tell us more about that. That sounds interesting.
Thanks. Thanks for having me again. It's always a pleasure being on here. Working with Nibala, it was like a fate just happened, because I was working on some top secret music project of my own, and next thing we know, Jonas ends up being my next door neighbor, which is really ironic considering we live in the middle of nowhere. And
well, maybe he's just following you.
So we started. He's probably stalking me because he knew that he needed some expert vocals on the Nibala to elevate them. So they packed up and moved to become my next door neighbor so that he could come knocking on my porch every day, begging me to do vocals for him. And I conceded and said, yes, I suppose I will save your project. No, but it's been really, really fun. We've been collaborating a lot, and I think Nibala is it's a really brilliant project that he's got going on. So it's so far been really fun, and I really look forward to the world hearing what we're creating.
Yeah, for sure. So me too. I mean, we've heard a little snippet of it. It's some really good stuff. I'm really excited to see what. Obviously, I've not heard anything you've done with him yet, but Jonas's stuff on its own, the Nibala stuff on its own, is really good. I've really kind of enjoyed it.
Yeah, he's got a vision, and I think that especially in this, I don't know what you want to call this type of genre, this approach towards music, incorporating old Nordic stuff into music. It's a really new genre, and it's a really oversaturated genre already. And you need to be a person with your own vision, I think, to stand out. And I think he's got that. So
me too. And that's a good point. Does this genre have a name? I guess I've never really, when people ask about it or mention it, I've never really thought of it as having its own kind of genre name.
Well, I mean, the thing about, you know, how does this genre get a name? Like, usually what you see is that, you know, people within the genre themselves give it a name. That's often how it works. But and then sometimes, you know, you find some kind of like a situation where it's being called like something by like a reviewer or something like that. Like the French band, isn't it a French band? Daft Punk, right? They got their own name from a reviewer who literally called their music Daft Punk in a review. So they were like, hey, let's take that. But yeah, so, and sometimes you also end up with like scholars ending up naming the genre for some reason, like in their studies of it. And personally, I call like whatever Wardruna, Heilung, Nibala, these bands are playing, I call that Nordic ambience, because like there's really no, I don't know if there's any other definitions of it. It's like,
that's it.
Sometimes, you know, they're lumped together with heavy metal, but I mean, it's hardly metal, right?
Let's coin the phrase, let's make our own. Heard it here first.
Oh, you want to be a first mover now, huh?
Yeah, well, that's it. We've done it. Now, before we jump in, obviously, this is the first live streamed episode of this podcast, which is going to our Patreon fans. Obviously, you get to see our pretty faces. We dropped on you last minute, Josh. You quickly went and kind of spruced yourself up a little bit.
I crawled out of bed.
And we just decided to tell you last minute, oh, by the way, this is videoed live.
Yeah, so I'm still trying to rub the bags out from under my hair.
That's it, yeah. And just on that note, we also just want to say to everybody listening that all the video episodes are now going to be live on YouTube. They're going to be live 1 month after kind of the audio is released. So Patreon will get 1 month first kind of exclusive rights to the videos, and then they'll go onto YouTube after that. And I think that's kind of it for Mal. Is one other quick thing. There's a nice gentleman called Joe Sheehan. If you remember, Matthias, he sent us a nice message a few months back. He said they listened to the podcast whilst he was running. I think he lost maybe like 30 kilos. He was really looking forward to watching the first live stream, but he sent me a message before saying he's gone to pick up his newborn son. So he's on his way to the hospital to pick up his new son, which I thought deserved a congratulations. Feel like maybe he needs to get his priorities right in what he's doing, but other than that, so, you know, he's a big fan. He kind of messages all the time. He supports us on Patreon. Just wanted to say, obviously, congratulations to him on that.
Yeah, congratulations, man. That's awesome news.
For sure. So, yeah, let's talk about Yule. We're in the festive period. It doesn't really feel it so much for me since I'm still working. I'm still stuck in a workshop pretty much 24 hours a day. But
isn't that exactly like the life of an elf, though? Isn't that Santa's elves?
That's it. Well, yeah. To be honest, that's probably what I feel like at the minute. You know, I'm crafting drinking horns and war horns, and it's like the list is never ending.
But those are cool toys for kids.
For sure, yeah, definitely. So I mean, last year, Matthias, we obviously did a Yule special, and I mean, to be fair, I've slept since then, and I've forgotten most of what we spoke about. So I don't think anyone will mind us kind of recapping where Yule comes from. Obviously, Josh, you study Norse religion or Old Norse religion. So yeah, let's get into it.
Yeah, where do you want to start? It's a huge pile of stuff to kind of unravel. I gave a lecture was it last week, I think, at the Midgard Center in Bora in Norway, and I said, well, where's the best place to start? First, I just pointed out that when researchers approach Yule to try and figure out, if we're trying to talk about, you have to talk about it, you have to pick where you want to start. Do you want to talk about modern Yule traditions? Do you want to talk about folk traditions? Do you want to try and figure out what Yule might have been in the prehistoric period? And I assume we want to talk about the prehistoric period. You want to talk about the Viking Age and stuff like that. So
I think for me, I would say just to maybe a good starting point is, I guess everyone has the the whether it's a misconception or the truth of this idea that Christmas was somehow made as an appeasement for the sort of pre-Christian people and the pagans. So they put they made Christmas as to tie in with the winter solstice. Is that something that makes sense? Or that's what I feel like that's what I've heard before, is that that's kind of where it comes from.
Well, I mean, where I started was I pointed out that Yule, or this thing that we call Yule, its origins are pre-Christian. But originally, as far as we can tell, it's the name of the lunar months that took place during, before and after the winter solstice. In fact, if you were to be paying attention, and if we listen to Anders Nordberg's study reconstructing the lunisolar calendar, which I think we have good reason to accept most of what he says in this case. Technically, the first Yule month started, yesterday? The 14th, the new moon, I think, happened yesterday. So we just started Yule.
Yeah.
But then there's things you can get into, you know. What ends up happening is...
So does that mean that Yule is a period of time rather than a singular day like Christmas is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And also, it also looks like the word was usually used in the plural. So that means then that it would be like multiple parties or fests or whatever, or a series of a period where there would be some kind of festivities. Just to add a thing to what you were saying about the word itself, it looks like it just actually means party. Yold. that seems to be its origin. The origin is a little debated, but it seems to originate from the same Indo-European stem as what we find with the Latin "jocus." So that means, you know, straight up partying. So that's where we're at with the origin of the word itself.
Right, and then there's lots of references to three nights of Yule. But then, there's been good reason to believe that perhaps festivals, sacrifices, and actual drinking festivals may have taken place during the full moon, perhaps after the solstice. And that could have been, and there's a lot of pretty strong evidence to indicate that there's some truth to that. But when you brought up the Christmas celebration of Christmas, there's actually a good number of references and even law codes are referring to the kings moving the heathen celebration of Yule to be when Christians celebrated Christmas. I think it was in Ynglingasaga. Hákon
the Good.
Yeah, Hákon the Good. Supposedly, Hákon the Good moved the celebration of Yule to when the Christians celebrated it. So he and before that, it says, I don't have it in front of me, but I do have it in front of me. And now there was Yule. Yeah, and before that was Yule held on the slaughter night. That was Midwinter's night, and then there was three nights of Yule. But he moved it to when the Christians celebrated it. And then Olavr Tryggvason, this is fun. Olavr Tryggvason made it. He abolished the drinking to bloat drinking. He made it so that it was illegal to drink to heathen gods. But as a favor to the people, he made it so that you could drink. You could drink for to in a Christian sense. So instead of drinking to the heathen gods, you could drink to Jesus and Saint Maria.
Mm. There's one thing to add about the story about Hákon the Good, and that is, of course, this is from the collection Heimskringla, so the collection of Norwegian king sagas that was supposedly written by Snorri Sturluson, even though that's pretty shaky. And the thing about this story is that... there's a lot of indication that it's a pretty made up story, the whole saga about Hákon. One thing is that, for instance, he's in this saga being it is said that he's a Christian king. He was like baptized when he grew up in England. Then he comes back to Norway. Norway is still pagan, but he wants to like impose Christian law on the country. But actually, there's a lot of other sources out there that claim that he was an apostate, so that he was basically a fallen Christian. He was baptized, and then he comes back to Norway, and he's like, "Wow, fuck it," and then goes about his business. So
I wonder
how many did that.
I mean, it feels like you just do what you need to do at the time. You know, I get baptized, and then when you go home, it's kind of like, eh.
Hákon Amal. I mean, Hákon Amal is it's a scalder poem, supposedly composed not during his lifetime, but right after his death in honor of him. Supposedly, I forgot the name. Was it I know Skatlaspitlet?
Could be. Yes. Yeah. It sounds about right.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's this awesome. Everybody likes to talk about the Eddic poems, but the Skaldic poems are much cooler.
And the old ones.
This poem about the. Yeah, and it's about Hákon dying in battle, because he died, and skeptical about going to Valhall and thinking that Odin's angry at him because he was a Christian. But at the end of the poem, he goes to Valhall because all good kings go to Valhall, or suppose according to the poem. And it tells you a lot about the propaganda at that time of the royal courts.
Absolutely, yeah.
The good kings go to Valhall because that's where you're supposed to go, whether you're a Christian or not.
And okay, so yeah, speaking of skaldic poems, what is Hrafnsmalo? Haraldskvæði is the oldest source that we have to the word Yule in Scandinavian context.
Haraldskvæði is an awesome
poem. It is, yes. And so this is the a eulogy composed to Harald Finnhair, the supposedly first king of Norway. We can always debate, how much he was actually a king of all of Norway, but that's another story. This poem mentions that he will have to drink Yule outside, basically, if he wants to continue his Freyr's play. And that basically means war. So basically what it's saying is that he'll have to celebrate Yule, on the move, like in the mountains or on a ship or something. I can't remember exactly how it goes, but something like that.
There's another cool theory to that actually Terry Gunnell had that I really liked. And there's, I talked about this during my lecture and I said, ute vik jordrekka, he wants to drink outside because, he's sick of sitting in all winter. And what, as you're saying, if this is interpreted as war, which it very well could be, he wants to go out and fight because that's what far fame seeking rulers do.
Mm-hmm.
So leikur meant drama, performance. That's what the word meant. Phrase leikur means the drama or the performance of Freyr. And of course, you could obviously interpret that as going to war, especially because Freyr was he wasn't, people like to think of him as a peace god, but he was also the god of aristocracy among the Ynglingar, and they were warrior people. So he could have been.
And he's supposed to take down a giant with a stag's antler. That's pretty warrior-like. Like, come on.
Right. And there's plenty of images of boars headed depictions of warriors, and so anyways, but Terry's, I gotta get this out there because it's cool. he suggested that it might have more to do with a ritual, of course, Terry, a ritual drama that had to do with Freyr, and he points to various mentions in the sagas to Leikir being almost like sacral competitions, which is a worldwide phenomena, particularly among indigenous people, that the competitions can be perceived as sacred.
Yeah,
and he points to the Gunnar Helming account. It's an account of an outlaw who flees to Sweden, and there's a priestess that takes a statue of a Freyr on a procession around to all the villages where they, they receive offerings, and in return the statue on behalf of the priestess blesses the people. And during this small story, the idol is angry at Gundar, and eventually it attacks him, and they wrestle, and he cheats by saying like, oh shit, if I win, I will convert to Christianity. And upon doing that, the Freyr leaves the idol, and he smashes the idol apart and puts on clothing and puts on a mask. And then he goes on this procession, and Terry has argued that perhaps this story is the echo of what once was perhaps a drama like perhaps what we see in Skidbladnir, with a procession in honor of Freyr during the dark time of the year to perhaps instill the crops to grow or something like that. And of course, it's very speculative, but I think there's some truth to it, especially you see terms like Lake Godi. Which is like kind of like the cultic organizer of competitions.
Yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense, actually.
So that leads me on to what I was going to ask next, which was, so now we kind of know what Yule is. You know, it's a festive period of partying, I guess. But so the obvious question is why? Like, why do this? Why set aside a period of time to party, I guess? It seems there must be a reason to it, because you wouldn't use your resources up if you didn't have to, or there wasn't kind of something to gain from it.
Well, I mean, so what we have is a period of the winter months are, you know, the time during the year where nothing grows, you're not producing crops and everything, so you're just digging into your storage. You want to save, especially in places like, you know, Scandinavia, you want to be saving your storage and preserving as much food as possible, because you never know how long this winter is going to go. Of course, you do have some ideas, but then you've also had the, you know, the cultural experience of you know, a volcanic eruption that also makes the winter a couple years too long. those kinds of things also happened once in a while. And the situation is then that, of course, you know, once you get to the point where you sort of like, you know, come to the middle of the winter, you might have been, you know, I don't know, living off of porridge or something for way too long, and then you're like, hey, we made some sausages earlier. Let's fry them up, let's take out the big fat boar that we have hanging around and fry him up, and then you know, get a little fat before we have to like go into the last leg of the winter here. That would make a lot of sense.
So that's kind of celebrating getting past the middle point of winter.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's also just to stock up on you know, nutrition for the last part of the winter in general.
Yeah, and I think it's especially in Scandinavia, this time of the year, and Yule, as we understand it, actually would have gone through January, and this is just—it's a dark, terrible time of the year. You're not out being active. If you're a warrior, you can't be doing the things you're supposed to be doing. If you're a farmer, you can't be doing the things you're supposed to be doing. And you're nervous. So this is a way to do. It does a few things. It brings up the morale. Parties, festivals, social gatherings bring up the morale. It's also a time to, I think, because this is also when the year begins, the annual year begins at the second month of Yule. So they're also celebrating that and maybe trying to, in their beliefs, get the year off to a proper start. But I also think that among the aristocracy, among the kings, this is a good time to demonstrate your wealth and your power by putting on a big party,
mm-hmm.
by telling all of the farmers that they have to come to, of course you make them brew their own beer, but make all the farmers come to you and you put on this big festivity. That shows them how powerful you are.
Some things never change. Do they just bring your own beer?
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, we have a question I just want to throw in there. So Shelley's asking, does the Yule log have anything to do with Yule and paganism at all? Josh, you want to fill that one?
Not that we know of. Not that I feel confident to drawing any particular strands or connections to. I never looked at the Yule log and tried to trace it back. But coming from my perspective and looking at the information we have on the old material, I don't see anything that I could draw to the Yule log. Do you?
No. This thing is completely unknown to Scandinavians, as far as I know. I mean, what is it, like German origins? Is that where it comes into? Or do you English? Do you do the Yule log thing? Or.
I don't know. I'm partial to liking one, but I don't know where it comes from.
Okay.
I mean, I'll eat a Yule log, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, no. So we don't have any traditions that I know of in Scandinavia of any like Yule log kind of thing.
I was just going to say, to piggyback on the back of that, something modern is kind of the Yule goat that you see as well. So yep. We mentioned this before. Like, where does that come from? It seems a bit of an odd thing to pop up.
I think that does have I was actually going to mention the Luce and the Oskarai the and the Wild Hunt and other, you know, because you had mentioned Yule being a time to party, but it's also seems to have been a time, it still is today, of creepy fucked up visitations.
That's any Scandinavian holiday, if you ask me. There's always going to be some creepy fucked up visitations,
especially during Yule. And then, in fact, isn't it the Algrip that the short history of the Norwegian kings that it claims that the origin of Yule was from Odin, whose name was Jolnir, and it's named after him. Of course, we don't believe that it's actually named after him, but he does seem to have some connection to Yule, with his, obviously, there's the mention of the toast to him, but we can't really trust so much from Heimskringla and the saga of Halcon the Good, where they say that the first toast was to Odin. But his connection to the Wild Hunt, which is of course a very post-medieval tradition, but it seems to, we see variations of the Wild Hunt throughout Northern Europe.
Western and Central Europe too.
Yeah. I mean, you can lump in the Purstalauf and the Oskarai. It's just this bizarre phenomena of hordes of spirits riding over and dragging you away, taking your wit, taking your soul, and there's a pretty wide tradition of Odin being at the head of it. Also Satan sometimes. But
also a dude named Volmer, though. Like, that's the Danish tradition, some dude named Volmer. It's like he's got no connection to anything at all. He's just the guy, I guess.
One day he got roped into being the leader.
I guess so.
Is that guy by accident that maybe looks at somebody wrong or puts the hand up and just suddenly becomes the leader?
Yeah. But the Yule book, the Yule book has, it's not that random when you really break it down. And you look at it in a context of the rest of Northern Europe, where people are donning animal skins and horns and going on a procession and demanding booze from their neighbors. We find this throughout Scandinavia during the Yule period. That's what the Purstalauf is, even so, down in Austria.
That's what trick or treating is too, right? You know, it's a from Halloween. Oh, by the way, Brewer Thompson is mentioning that there are Tudor instances of Yule Midwinter log. Maybe older references in English folklore and folk traditions too. I mean, it's not unlikely that this is a particularly English kind of thing, but I mean, I don't, my knowledge isn't that expensive on that. So
I mean, cake and cream is quite English, so I wouldn't be surprised.
Right, but one thing I'm sort of like I'm thinking of here is the amount of spices that are thrown into these kinds of things. Like that's always the kind of thing that makes me think, early modern tradition more than anything, because you know, like we didn't have access to that many spices prior to the early modern period. Like in Scandinavia, we love to give rice pudding, rice porridge, risengrød, as we call it, to the nisse, the elf, and you know that rice porridge right there, you can get very similar things out of India, you know, very sweet, spiced up stuff, cinnamon, you know, so I'm pretty sure that we at some point, sort of in Northern Europe, we copied a tradition that comes from over there, probably in the 16, 1700s or something like that. And it's the same with like other dishes that you eat around Christmas time. They seem to have been inspired by stuff that you get in like the Middle East and India, because they have a lot of spice and seem to be very similar recipes actually.
But I think perhaps eating ham during Yule, that we could probably say is a tradition that took place during the Viking Age. Because boar is an indigenous animal to Scandinavia, and B, because we actually have references to sacrificing swine during Yule for a feast.
Mm-hmm.
So
we have an instance of a king, who is it, who swears on the back of a boar at Yule. That's like
on the bristles of the boar.
Yes,
on the bristles.
The bristles. So one thing to say about this is that we know for a fact, though, that this is not a who?
King Heidrek.
Heidrek. Yes.
According to Heidrek's Konungs in the Fornolda Saga Nordlanda. So
yes, yeah. Sounds about right. Totally. Yes. One thing I would say about this, though, is that you cannot expect that is like a tradition that has existed from the Viking Age and then like all the way into modern times. That's definitely not the case. We know for a fact, for instance, that eating roasted boar in Scandinavia becomes a thing in the 19th century when people start getting cast iron stoves. Before then, it wasn't that common actually to eat a pig for Christmas. So you know, there's like, you know, it goes back and forth, and you know, some periods have other traditions, or you know, and so on. Nowadays, like a country like Denmark is like split in two kinds of people: the people who eat duck or goose, or the people who eat, you know, pig for Christmas. And like, we could have a civil war over that, I'm sure.
We're about to have a civil war in my house. Oh, on Thorlaksmessa, but it's an Icelandic holiday, the 23rd in Iceland. The country is split in half and households are ripped apart because people, because in order to celebrate Thorlaksmessa, roughly half the country eats this fermented skata, this fermented stingray, and they boil it, which means it's nasty, putrid stench.
Fumes.
Because your house becomes a sauna of putrescence, and of course half the, and the other half of Iceland says this is fucking disgusting. Go out and cook it in the backyard, and that's what people do.
Josh, do you remember the time we almost got kicked out of Dillon? Because you were eating dried fish in there.
And I also remember you being told by a drunk Icelandic guy that Danish isn't a real language. It's a low German dialect.
That is true. Yes. He was right, though.
So Icelanders have strong opinions about Danish. No, but I live in Norway now, of course. But of course, my household is Icelandic, except for me. And My girlfriend decided she wants to introduce all of the neighbors to this wonderful Icelandic tradition. So she and her sister, they ordered, I think we have like 4 kilos of rotting skata downstairs. Wow. Waiting for the 23rd, and I'm gonna have to be the one to cook it.
That sounds horrendous.
It's pretty bad because it's hot and steamy.
So to jump back, I still want to get to the starting point of this goat. So,
oh right, the goat. Yes,
where does the goat come from? Because it is something you see though, like it's very typical. Usually, maybe like a wicker goat. You know, it's got its horns curled around, and people hang it from the tree. Now, where does that come from? Is there I was wondering if there's any kind of basis for that, or is that kind of like a modern thing?
I think the little straw decoration, that's modern.
Okay.
But the older tradition, which can be traced back into the Middle Ages or the late Middle Ages, of donning a goat skin and holding a skull with horns or having a mask with horns, that seems to be what at one point was a fairly widespread Yule buck tradition. And it would go from house to house, and there's many variations of it, but it involved dancing, getting a booze. One interesting thing is that in some traditions, the person who was dressed as the Yule buck would ritually die. They would fall on the ground, and then they would bring it back to life. And I think a new person would become the Yule buck and dance around. And now I'm getting into weird, weird speculative territory, and there's no basis for this. But it does remind me a little bit of Thor's goats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
And the ritual slaughter and the bringing back to life. Mm. I don't know if there's a connection, but
so
I think maybe in a modern context, if you wanted to reconstruct this or create a new tradition, could probably connect the two.
So there's a couple of things here. First of all, we have 16th, 14th, 15th century Scandinavian accounts of like the Yule goat as like a person who is dressed up, and this was this wasn't just for Christmas. You can also find it in other contexts. I believe when you got initiated into becoming a student at the University of Copenhagen, people would dress you up as a goat and beat the shit out of you. yeah, I don't know.
Like, sounds like a weird initiation.
You know, there's a lot of that out there. So that's one thing. But aside from that, the earliest accounts in Denmark of the straw goat are actually from like 1945. So they're okay. Really, really recent for Denmark. I don't know about Sweden and Norway or Iceland for that matter. And obviously, the cool thing nowadays are the giant wicker goats in Sweden, where they put this giant wicker goat out. And I think it's in the town square or something like that. It's huge, like, you know, the size of a small house. And then there's always some asshole who lights it on fire.
It's been happening.
Yes, this has been happening since the 70s.
This tradition has spread to Iceland because, of course, outside of IKEA, they put up a giant Yule goat and then it burns. And then somebody burns it down.
So it seems that the wicker goat is kind of modern commercialization of Yule.
Probably, yeah. You know, the idea of like the goat or somebody dressing up as a goat and all that stuff, that seems to be quite old. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure it can be associated with the Pacht in Leuven and the whole Krampus stuff. Like it's the same tradition that we're dealing with here, and so we can locate those in. As their own distinct thing in the 1400s, 1500s in the German area. So basically the general idea is like for Christmas, you have, you know, the representation of good in Santa. He's Saint Nicholas, right? Mm-hmm. He's the that saint who once threw some money in through a window somewhere because he heard somebody talking about they couldn't pay the bills or something. I can't really remember the story, but something like that. And then you have the representation of Satan coming with him, right? So the whole idea of like some people get presents because they've been nice and virtuous, and some people they get beaten. Or put in a sack or something, and that's what the goat is for, right? But if we go even further back, what we can see, of course, is that the image itself, like the horned, furry figure that represents Satan, is borrowing from pre-Christian figures of various kinds. The Roman god Pan is, of course, a great example of this. What we're dealing with is probably more like the reuse of imagery, recycling of old ideas and they're being recast in new forms. So that's probably where the origins of this goat.
Okay. So you've mentioned kind of sacrifice a little bit in here. Now, is that kind of sacrificing just for the meat for the party, or is there a meaning behind that? Is this kind of like a sacrifice to hope that the farming goes well in the next year?
I don't want to project a definite meaning on sacrifice over, you know, Scandinavia before Christianity was many different ethnic groups, and also it's a long period of time. So sacrifice would have taken on many different meanings.
Okay.
But it wasn't just to have a party, certainly not. It would have had the sacral meanings. Whether it was to appease the gods or to get omens from the gods or for peace and prosperity or other that and everything else. I think that sacrifice wasn't just to have a feast, mm-hmm. but having a feast definitely was part of the after effect of having a sacrifice.
You enjoyed the meat after the killing.
Yeah. Right, but then the killing was a spectacle in and of itself, mm-hmm. and probably played a very important role in the cosmic lives of people at that time.
Okay, so we haven't spoke about sacrifice too much on the podcast before, and what it meant, I guess, to people back then.
Well, I mean, there are different. As Josh is saying, the different reasons for making sacrifices. So again, we have to be very careful when we're interpreting like Nordic mythology and the material there, because you know so much of it is written from a distinct Christian ideological perspective, like Snorri Sturluson, for instance. But it is interesting to see though that you could pair what Snorri is telling us about the creation myth, like the creation of the world, where there's like sort of a purification of the world through Ymir's blood, the primordial giant that is literally like sacrificed by Odin and his brothers. Of course, this carries a lot of interpretations, but what we're basically seeing in Snorri's version here is that Ymir is like creating all of these like frost giants and giants the Jötnar, so negative beings, forces, demons, whatever you want to call them, right? That are harassing the world, and then Odin and his brothers they kill Ymir, and his blood drowns all of these harassing forces. And that could, like, if you are willing to accept that version of the creation of the world as sort of a foundational theology for sacrifice, that could then be sort of like the idea that is behind some of the sacrifices that people have, like blood sacrifices, where the blood is some kind of like purifying substance. We see this in multiple other cultures, so it's not improbable to consider. But aside from that, if we go to perhaps better sources when it comes to like how did these people think about sacrifices, it's definitely a reciprocal act, right? So if we take Ibn Fadlan's story about the Rus, possibly like Swedish Viking trader that he encounters over in Russia on the banks of the Volga River. He tells us that that this guy, he goes to like these statues of his gods, and then he gives them, you know, offerings of food and drink and a couple of like weird things like onion, you know. and then he says like, take these gifts, and then he's like very specific about what he actually wants. Like, he says, give me a customer that'll buy my stuff for exactly the price that I'm asking. Like, very specific. And then he goes back, and then he sells, and he keeps coming back and giving offerings until he gets what he wants. And then once he's gotten what he wants and sold all his stuff, then he makes this huge sacrifice as sort of like a thank you note to the gods, where he gives a portion of the meat to the deities, to the idols. And then he gives another portion as a feast and as what Ibn Fadlan calls alms. So that's some kind of a gift to the poor or something like that. So that is a very reciprocal act, and it seems to, you know, be very meaningful in sort of both a religious and social context. And that's probably where we should like look for answers to, like, why did they do sacrifices? It was definitely this idea that I give something to the gods, then the gods give me something back, and everything exists in like these reciprocal relations. Me and other humans, me, the gods, me and demons, whatever that exists out there.
And you see that reciprocal relationship everywhere. I mean, that was a relationship between kings and their sworn warriors, was a reciprocal oaths, gifting in return, the cycle. And you can often see mirrored relationships between humans and non-humans, gods, spirits, the earth. You can often see those relationships mirrored in the human relationships themselves with each other. But there's also lots of other accounts of that it was reciprocal. Adam of Bremen also describes that it's reciprocal, that they gave to, of course, you can't take everything that he, I trust Ibn Fadlan's account much more than Adam of Bremen's, but still, he describes that they gave offerings to Odin for this, and Thor for this, and Freyr for this, and even up through, even in modern times, people give offerings to the Nisse and the Tomten for, in exchange for things. It's a reciprocal relationship. They give them porridge so that they don't steal their cattle and burn down their barn, and also so that they protect their barn. So it's both. It's don't destroy us, but also be on our side. It's maintaining a relationship.
Yeah.
But I like how in the Ibn Fadlan account, as an omen that the gods accepted his offerings would be that the dogs ate the food.
Yeah. I think that's Ibn Fadlan's personal comment to all of this. It's like, yeah, the dogs come and eat it. It's like these people.
And then they go, oh, they accepted it.
Yeah. I mean,
that sounds so weird. It's accepted when something comes and eats it. It's like, well, yeah, of course the dogs are going to come fucking eat it. You're leaving food there.
Well, I mean, Ibn Fadlan is a Muslim intellectual from like the one of the most like civilized centers of the planet at the time, right? Like, he looks at these guys and he's like, they're obviously idiots, because like in Islam you're not supposed to sacrifice. That doesn't make any sense in the theology of Islam, just like in Christianity. But on the other hand, you could, if your perspective on the world is animistic relational, like that type of thinking that was probably present in Scandinavia pre-conversion, then it makes perfect sense that, oh yeah, of course the dogs are eating it. That doesn't mean that Odin hasn't taken it. That's not a like a logical problem to them at all. They'd just be like, yeah, that makes sense.
They may as well. Somebody may as well eat it.
right?
So, I mean, whilst we're on this subject, I've got to ask, because we may not come back to sacrifice for a while. I guess human sacrifice. Obviously, we see it was quite popular with the Aztecs. Obviously, it's quite famously in Vikings, the TV show as well. They do a little bit of that. Is there any truth to that? Is it really? Did they practice human sacrifice, or was it mainly animals?
There's a lot of human sacrifice. Oh,
okay, so I was going to say it's one thing leaving a loaf of bread or some grain out, and then it's another thing killing a man and being like, here.
When you're a warrior king who takes prisoners and who can declare war on people and who has captives, you can easily declare that there's going to be a sacrifice. But also, I think because a lot of modern people, we like to project. Of course, we all like to project our preconceived ideas onto the past. Mm-hmm. And that makes for a lot of apologists who want to, you know, because heathen and pagan religions have been viewed in a negative light for so long. Now I notice in a lot of neo-pagans and kind of Nordic spiritual apologists, they like to project the noble savage, where no, they wouldn't do that. There's no reason why they wouldn't do that. We're talking about a lot of different people, a lot of different types of people, and you know, one example of because people also like to break it down and say, well, maybe what we call human sacrifice was really just execution of prisoners. That's still an attempt at modernizing the past. But I like to shine a light on, you know, not just the bog bodies, but we'll talk about the back to Ibn Fadlan. And this unsettling account of a chieftain's burial on the river, and a slave girl is buried with him, and as far as I'm concerned, and I think most other researchers are concerned, his account is not all of it is reliable, but much of it is reliable, and in this account, and. You find bodies with an old person that died along with a young person buried with them. You find this in the Oseberg, the Oseberg ship, and you see it in other cultures where young people or slaves or wives die to go or be with their husbands. You see it in with Sufi. Is it Sufi? No, what's it called?
Suti.
Sutti, yeah,
the Indian practice.
And you see this reflected in and now, of course, we're getting to speculative again. But Balder's wife throwing herself onto the pyre to die with him. I think it is completely reasonable to assume that in times and places, people willingly or unwilling, you know, people did. Die to go to the other place with somebody or to appease a god or something like that. It's
how much of that was willing and how much of it was forced. Because I guess for me, I'm just kind of thinking that's a really shit deal. You know, if say your husband or wife died and they're kind of just like, sorry, but you've got to go as well.
So the thing is, I don't know if anybody has written a book, The Psychology of Human Sacrifice, to actually figure out what is going on here. But you know, there's some things you can say about, like, for instance, let's take the account that Ibn Fadlan gives us about this slave woman. So we have a chieftain who dies, and then they ask his slaves who wish to go with him into death. And then this slave woman says, well, I'll do it. And so that's like the first remark that we can make here is that, oh, this looks like she freely and willingly chooses to do that. And it's like, yeah, sure. But she's also a slave. So yeah,
just be her being sick of being a slave. So it's an out, you know, it's I don't want to work in the fields anymore. So.
That's a good possibility. That's a good suggestion. There's also another thing to consider here, and that is like the change in treatment that she receives after she has been she has said that yes, I'll do it. Like for a period of time, she seems to be living what Imfadlan is describing as kind of a nice life. Like she's drinking and singing songs. The other slaves are like treating her as a high-ranking elite individual. They're like washing her feet and stuff like that.
Well, she's also being gang-banged, though.
Well, see, that comes later, right? So what happens next then, like so in this period where she, I think it's about 10 days, right, where they're like making his clothes and a lot of other things, she is living some kind of life that seems like, at least on the surface, as like pretty nice. Mm-hmm. You can ask like a couple of things, like for instance, the song and the drinking. Is that just her merrymaking and being like hobbit drunk or whatever? Or are we dealing with some ritual?
Dutch courage. It's kind of like, I'm going to be fucking killed in a few days. I might as well.
Well, see, that's a possibility, but there's also, it could also all be ritualistic for some reason. Like the drinking and all that stuff could mm-hmm. have ritual components to it. But yeah, and then what happens like on the day of the burial and the sacrifice and everything? Like she is like gang raped first by all his buddies, and then later on also on the ship afterwards. That's pretty intense. Like I use this in my classes, and I usually have students that are like very much trying to avoid that subject because it's like pretty nasty, actually. And so again, you have to ask yourself, like, what is happening here? Is this something that I mean, obviously, from modern ethical standards, none of this can be considered acceptable whatsoever, right? But from their perspective, from their way of thinking, what did they think about that? What did she think about it? Was this was this something that was acceptable? I mean, yeah, it looks like it.
Our subjective realities, they can be vastly different. I mean, this is why people get culture shock when they enter another culture. And I mean, here we're talking about a society with a way of life and a way of looking at reality that is completely different from our own.
Mm-hmm.
And when each of them has sex with her, he says, "I do this for you. I do this to you out of love for your master or our master," or something like that. But there's another interesting account. I always, even when I'm reading it, it's a 1,000-year-old account, and it's still unsettling. And at the end, he describes she's given a drink, but she becomes nervous. She suddenly seems to not want to be there anymore, not to participate any longer. So the fun and games are over, and that's where they start banging on shields so you can't hear her screaming, and they strangle her. Mm-hmm. And it's quite unsettling, but there does seem to be, I mean, we talk about the willingness of human sacrifices. We know that given your subjective view on reality and your place in the world and your there are people who willingly sacrifice themselves. I mean, what does it take to get young men to willingly charge out into a wall of spears and swords? I mean, it's the belief that you're going to go to Valhalla, or something like that. What makes a person walk into a building and set off a bomb? I mean, we see it in our own day, people performing what they view as a human sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a good point. And also, I mean, what was it, like 15, 20 years ago, there was like this, this German guy who literally wanted to be eaten by this cannibal guy. Like,
oh shit, that happened.
They made a song after it.
Yeah, yes. I forgot oh. about that.
Bloodbath song Eaten is inspired by that account.
Yeah, Rammstein had a song about it too.
But that's
okay.
That is such an insane story.
It is, yeah. But I mean, and obviously you can dig into a lot about this guy's psychology. But nonetheless, that happened. So, yeah, I mean, who are we to say exactly, what is going on in the minds of these peoples who are doing these things? And reality is incredibly subjective. I think that has just been proven, by the way, with quantum physics or something like that.
For sure. I think we definitely need to take a moment, or some people definitely need to take a moment and try and not put, modern times onto how they acted. You know, like you say, 1,000 years ago, it's just different. And it kind of boggles my mind how some people aren't able to just separate the two and just think of them as, it's just different. And right or wrong, it's different. It's just how it was then.
Yeah, and
they had
also
a different right and wrong.
Let me just put something else out there. The type of Christianity that existed just 500 years ago or 200 years ago is fundamentally different from the type of Christianity that you find in any Western society today.
I'm sure in 50 years, 100 years, it will be completely different than it is today.
Yeah, and that's just how it is, you know. Mm-hmm. things and times change.
Would the sacrifice E go with the kind of main person who's died to save Valhalla? So if he was, you know, a chieftain who died and he's going to Valhalla, if somebody is sacrificed along with them, would they join them in the same place in the next life? Could that be a reason why somebody would choose to take it, because it's their opportunity as a slave maybe to go to somewhere better?
That's the case with the story of the slave woman. She's is supposed to join her master in Valhut or whatever it is where they're going.
The last thing I wanted to ask was, does the status of the human sacrifice make a difference to the reward you get from the sacrifice, if that makes sense? So if you I guess sacrificing a slave would be different to sacrificing a free person or somebody of higher status.
I don't think so.
Or do we have any examples of non-slaves being sacrificed? Because I guess that's the kind of the thing with Vikings. They pick somebody who's out there.
I mean, just the claim that Odin, I mean, the notion that those who die on the battlefield are chosen by Odin, that's an idea of human sacrifice. So I think often what to get sacrificed is based entirely on the context of, it's entirely contextual. I mean, sacrificing a chicken, you see this in throwing a chicken on the boat in the back to Ibn Fadlan. We can find an interesting correlation in Saxo Grammaticus's stories with which hero is it?
Saxo Grammaticus is the Danish historian who's writing several centuries later. And there's there can be no. It is impossible for there to be any crossover between these two texts. But just to give a rundown of it, right? So we have in the sacrifice of the slave girl in Ibn Fadlan's story, she cuts the head off a chicken, throws away the head, and puts the body of the chicken on the boat. And then Saxo, the Danish historian, several centuries later, is describing the story about King Hatting, the legendary Danish king, who's taken through the underworld by a völva or something like that. And there, he's shown all of these images of what is basically Valhalla, warriors fighting for an eternity, all kinds of stuff down there. And then once they're supposed to leave again, they find this wall that they can't cross. And then this völva takes a rooster and cuts the head off of it, and then throws the head over the wall. And then he hears it. What do they do? Croak, roost, whatever. The noise that the rooster makes on the other side of the. Fine, whatever. on the other side of the wall, and then poof, he's back in our reality. So it's this is a structural thing that is it looks like it's a real ritual that people have been doing, and it's straight up voodoo.
Yeah, because people always killing an animal or ritually destroying an object doesn't necessarily mean you're giving it to somebody. You could be transforming it. It could be playing a ritual. It's playing a purpose. So the chicken comes to life on the other side and crows. It plays it's an emissary of sorts. So is there a hierarchy to what you sacrifice? I think that depends on the sacrifice. I don't like to, you know, we say sacrifice, but the old word was either fort or bloat. And they don't necessarily mean sacrifice. They mean a lot of things, and they entail sacrifices. But these are, I think that if we were to go back in time, these would have been quite complicated rituals that would have been tied up with a lot of concepts.
Mm-hmm. And that's another thing. There seem to have been so many steps to it, right? If we go to stanza 144 in Hávamál as like perhaps an example of something, some ritual actions, right? Veistuque ristaskal, veistuque raudaskal, and so on. So this is like Odin is asking here, do you know how to carve? Do you know how to ask? Do you know how to send? Do you know how to partition or slaughter, or do you know how to sacrifice, and so on and so on. There's like several things that are involved here. It looks like sort of it could be some kind of like step-by-step manual for how to do ritual, mm-hmm. especially in context of runes, actually, which is another interesting can of worms that I'm not going to open anyway.
not right now.
Not right now. But so of course, what is always at the core of these types of rituals, and this is what you could also see with like modern traditions of this type of religion, like for instance voodoo that I was mentioned just before. There are like these rituals have so many tight components, and there are very specific rules that you have to follow, very specific things that you have to say at certain times, and it's like and this is also kind of what we're seeing in his description, Ibn Fadlan's description of that guy who's asking for a customer who's stupid enough to pay the price that he wants. Like he's also being incredibly specific in what he's actually asking for here. So it looks like that's part of like the general idea of ritual magic in and of itself, that it has to be very specific. It has to follow very, very strict rules for engagement, basically, and then it will work. And yeah, if you miss a step, you've probably fucked up the whole thing, and you're gonna have to like wait for the next full moon or I don't know what.
I mean, yeah, so it seems that kind of you have to forget modern perceptions of how we see things, as in most people now, I assume, or a vast majority of people kind of don't think of an afterlife. They kind of assume we die and that's it. It's lights out. It's kind of game over, however you want to say it. Whereas back then, and it certainly was like in the Viking Age and Egyptians, that death wasn't the end. It was just more, even possibly the beginning of something else. So with sacrifice, it's kind of, it's not, I always think of like sacrificing is giving something and breaking it and it's gone, it's destroyed, you've gotten rid of it. Whereas it's not necessarily maybe that, it's more, it's gone in this life, but it may live on in the next.
Yeah, no, I think that this is one of many reasons why people, again, the word sacrifice, sacrifice isn't the word they use. So, and that's interesting because that means we need to then shift into a cultural context. What does it mean to destroy something? What does it mean to send something somewhere else? I think there is truth that obviously there were afterlife beliefs of some sort. They probably weren't as structured as even we are handed them, because we're handed them in a written form after the fact. Although I think if you were to go to a certain village, you know, and, you know, go to Trondheim, or the Trøndelag area in the late 800s, I think that the people there there would be an idea of what happens when you die. And there would be rules about it. And I think that this, but if you were to go 100 miles south, they might have some very different rules. What we have, it's very hard to splice who believed what and where they believed it and when they believed it in the Viking Age. But I think it's, and this is what a lot of researchers try to spend their time doing, is arguing over what were Viking Age beliefs, afterlife beliefs, you know? The Valhalla thing probably had truth to it, and at least in the late Viking Age, among very specific people, kings and their close retinues. But I don't think you would find the cabbage farmer believing, or even maybe even knowing about the Valhalla.
I would say that's a good point, and we've mentioned it before, that everybody looks for these boxes to put all of this into, right, and say they all believed this. When you're talking about such a big geographical area over a vast time period, when it wasn't like it is now. We live in a global community where you can speak to somebody in China, Australia, in a millisecond you can send a message and have a conversation. Whereas it just wasn't like that. You would have villages that were 20 miles apart but may think totally different things because they just didn't mix.
Yeah, and this is along the same lines that what I wanted to say. You know, it's this, these ideas of like, oh, they thought in this particular way, or they believed this particular thing, all comes from sort of the canonization of the literature that we have, right? So like the poetic Edda and Snorri Sturluson's Edda, and maybe some auxiliary texts, and that's the stuff that's sort of like, that's how Vikings or Scandinavians in the Viking Age or even before believed about the world. That's not necessarily true. I mean, those stories could be the product of a very, very small group of Scandinavians. And also, like, you know, we tend to have like this idea that, oh, the poetic Edda, because it contains poetry, some of it seems to be much older than the time it was written, first of all, and secondly, maybe even older than the conversion and so on, then it's some sort of like a better source than Snorri Sturluson's Edda. And it's like, you know, as I wrote in my most recent blog post, it's all crappy sources, guys. Like, literally none of it is particularly good sources.
The more we do this, it just feels like the less, like, people actually know about the Viking Age.
That's a good thing, though, because it's good. The experts are the ones saying, like, we can say a couple things that we might think we kind of know, but probably not. Mm-hmm. We probably don't know very much. And it's the people who don't know very much that are on the internet
that are usually very sure about things. Yeah.
Well, that's a point I just quickly wanted to make. And I think that's probably, I fell victim to that before I started the podcast with Mateus. I think because I knew very little, I assumed that there were these rules to things and that what you read was absolute fact. So I fell into this kind of position of almost preaching it as being fact. And then the more we've done the podcast, you know, we're coming up to like 42 episodes now, the more I've kind of just gone, fuck me, I know nothing. and the more I learn from Mateus and from, you know, all the awesome guests we have on here, I'm like, fuck me, I really do know absolutely nothing. So I just then tend to shut up and try and not say anything elsewhere because I realize how little I actually do know. And like Josh said, it tends to be the people who know, even I don't know much, but know even less than I do, that tend to preach, because I think I was in that position. I understand you know that little that what you do know, you almost believe is fact. Does that make sense?
You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, you don't know how little even like the top scholars know. Mm. You just kind of assume the little bits of information that come out are gospel when the truth is they're really not.
But that's also why it's so important for scholars to be very open about the fact that what they're presenting to you right now, what I'm telling you right now, is a theory. This is something that, I mean, yeah, I'm an expert on this stuff. I have spent the better part of my life studying this stuff. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I have like this solid rock knowledge on like exactly what Viking Joe Schmo in 800 and something thought about their world or anything like that. Absolutely not. But I can give you a theory on it, right? And I can give you like these, like, and say that this source over here says this, that source over there says that. We have some archaeological material over here, and then we have some comparative material that we can throw into the mix, and then we, something will come out. That's my theory on it. And that theory I could go to a conference where, you know, all the other scholars in this field show up, and then I can tell them my thoughts on this and that theory. And usually, you know, generally, if you're not, you know, bad at your job, they will tell you, yeah, that sounds reasonable. Although I would say this, and this. Or somebody would say, yeah, you know what, like, I'm not sure you should, like, use that particular theory. I don't know if it's applicable to this and that. I mean, if you're really bad at your job, you know, everybody will be silent and say nothing at all. except, of course, afterwards, when they're having beer with each other, they will say stuff about it.
I was going to say, except those beers start flowing.
But you know, it's a discursive science, though, because I don't want to. We do have a much better view. We are much more informed to talk about the past today than when you read the text from 50 years ago or 70 years ago. Because of interdisciplinary studies, and we have a much more contextual approach to the past, and I think that it doesn't mean that we've figured out the past. We're never going to figure out what, you know, I'm never going to be able to magically reveal unto you the religion of the Vikings. I mean, even saying religion of the Vikings is making some people go, no, because Vikings were just pirates. Mm-hmm. But
and it wasn't just one religion, it was multiple. You know,
it was many. Yeah, exactly. So, but the thing is, what you think is, if you go back 100 years ago, you're going to have people, I mean, what is this? Awfully outdated research of Wilhelm Grunbeck, who's constantly being cited on the internet.
Yeah, that's a
and,
thing.
And I mean, and yeah, it's a thing. But and it really needs to be addressed. I mean, academia is so far beyond that. But we as researchers need to be talking to people to kind of show why the things that somebody said 120 years ago, why they are so flawed. You can't talk about the past in such a homogenous way, for one thing.
Yeah. No, that's true, and it is incredibly important. Like, so, I mean, I took a little flack for my supposedly hard criticism of Neil Price's Children of Ash and Elm. But the criticism that I levied against him in that, right, is basically his use of mythology and textual material. Because he's not using it particularly well, and he's definitely not being clear about the fact that these are like his theories, and they haven't necessarily been tested with other scholars, or when they have, some of them have also been shut down. And that's incredibly important. Take for instance, he mentions the 536. Dust veil event as something that has been incredibly impactful on Scandinavian culture and society overall in the 500s, because this dust veil supposedly darkened the skies for about like 3 years or something like that. Hence, where this is where the myth of the this 3 year long winter comes from. That's his theory. I heard this theory first time in 2009 at the Saga conference in Uppsala, where the Swedish archaeologist Bo Gräslund, whom Price has been working with, presented this theory. And I was very skeptical about it. But it has since then taken on traction. And like, I mean, my specialty is, you know, interpreting volcanic shit into Nordic mythology. That's why I wrote my PhD on. And you know, there's something to be said for what Neil Price is saying, but I think he's making a very big deal out of it in his book, and I think he's also not making it clear that this is his theory and a theory that, mm-hmm. that is supported by some archaeologists, but not like universally accepted by scholarship. I can name the first 50 textual scholars who will not accept this theory, just like they won't with my interpretation of volcanic contexts for some of the Nordic mythology. That's a matter of like whether or not you're willing to accept the premise of the interpretation. Are you willing to accept that this is the direction that we're going? Also, are you informed about the same context as well, the comparative material and so on? And so it's like, you know, even though I might actually agree with Neil Price on the significance of the dust veil event and all that stuff, I still think he should have like made it very clear that this was his personal interpretation, right? That's an example of how these things go and how these like how we as scholars definitely need to be much more clear about when we are like presenting a theory that isn't necessarily accepted, you know, universally, and it's definitely not like the known fact about how the world functions and all that stuff.
Well, there goes us getting Neil Price on the podcast.
Hey, never say never, man.
This is why I didn't lose interest in it, but from an academic perspective, I this is why I shifted from, you know, my background is as a researcher of Old Norse religion. I shifted for my PhD dissertation to look at and discuss Old Norse religion's reception today, in particularly in neo-pagan and Nordic neo-pagan. I shouldn't say Nordic because I'm also looking at groups in the United States, but modern people, contemporary heathens who, you know, are using Old Norse religion as their religious inspiration. Because I got so it is fun to shoot theories at each other and argue about theories and discuss. But once you look at the material, I mean, the material is always the material. And from there, we're always drawing on it and trying to reevaluate and come up with new theories. And I decided at a certain point I didn't want to continue to come up with new theories. I wasn't interested so much in it anymore. I had suddenly become interested in how people are receiving all of these theories and all of these interpretations and the material itself. That's kind of a lot more kind of fun at the moment, looking, because I think, you know, we can talk all day about Old Norse religion, but it's just as important, if not more important, to talk about what Old Norse religion means today, why it's important that we talk about our theories, and why it's important to differentiate between what we know about the past and what is our way of kind of receiving the past and trying to piece it together into a new way of looking at things. And this is very important because, yeah.
No, I was just going to like support you in that and say this is so incredibly important because the past is being used, you know, and that's just Nordic past, all kinds of pasts, basically, all different, you know, levels of history, time periods are being used for people's personal identification of who they are today, their constructions of identities, right? And so it is incredibly important to be aware that, you know, our knowledge of the past is actually pretty spotty. That's not just, you know, each time period, regardless of what the level of source material it has available to us, is still an uncertain period of time. Like, you know, you could look, we can go back to the 1970s and like debate forever what really happened at like in Watergate and all of those things, right? And or with the oil crisis and so on, right? We can see some certain things are like verifiable. This happened, of course, but all the sentiments of individuals involved in all of this and the purpose and all that stuff, that can be incredibly hard to actually discern, even just, you know, 40 years ago. Go back to World War II. World War II is a fucking shit show when it comes to interpretations of what really happened and so on and so on and so on, right? Again, we can see, yeah, there are certain, like, this is a verifiable event and so on and so on and so on. But, like, people's motivations, why they were there, why they did what they did and so on, that can be incredibly hard to figure out. Like, even so close.
And that's more important.
Yeah.
And it's often more, it's more important to know why people were there and how people were affected by an event than to recite the event itself. An event in and of itself, it's just a vacuum sealed thing. What matters is how it's connected to everything else, and that's how people, the motivations and the responses. So
perfect. Yeah. No, this has been fun. That seems like a good point to let's wrap this one up.
Yeah.
It's been good fun. Josh, have you got anything you want to plug? Anything you're working on at the minute? Any your personal social medias?
I try to keep my personal like Instagram and my personal Facebook. I don't really use it for a promotional purpose per se. But I guess this has been the Corona year has been a terrible year. So if you haven't checked out the new Nexion album, our first album, check it out if you like black and death metal, and check out Nibala because it's definitely something interesting, and I'm excited to be a part of that.
For sure. I mean, I would say I listened to the Nexion album the other day, and it's certainly worth checking out. Definitely give it a listen.
Yeah, and then I mean I don't know what the future holds, but last time we talked, we were in this situation, and now we're still in it. But maybe things look like they still got a ways to go, but at least it looks like there's something coming around the corner of positivity.
Hopefully, so. Hopefully,
I'm strangely optimistic.
I'm never optimistic. You can carry the optimism for me.
Okay. So like I said, we're just going to take one last question before we wrap up completely. Shirley asked, what is the most extraordinary Yule tradition that you either do or know about? So is there anything you've learned in your research, Josh or Mateus?
I've been to multiple pig sacrifices for Yule.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I bet that's a fun one.
I was not the one doing the killing, but the one who it was all legal, and it was a farm raised, farm bought, and humanely, legally slaughtered. But it was at a bloat, and it was all the meat was eaten and stuff like that. But it was an animal bloat in a modern context. I attended it. That was probably the most extraordinary.
Well, that's it though. You have two ends of the spectrum now, though, don't you? You have some people who still kind of have that hunt inside and see this, but then you also have this other side of people that are so far removed from that and what happens that it's completely shocking. I imagine some people, the idea of you even going to something like that, where in modern context that a pig is sacrificed, is just so unusual and almost outlandish, I guess. But it is just these two spectrums that do exist. It's only recently that we've become kind of so detached from how the meat gets to our table. You know, you get it in the supermarket in a nice little cellophane packet. It doesn't look like the animal.
That animal has probably lived a pretty horrible life in some factory farm somewhere.
Yeah, and you know, this is, I think, you know, I don't really, if I had a stance on how we should treat animals, it would probably be something along the lines of I would just probably echo David Attenborough in his latest special, and that is that, you know, we should be caring for the environment and making sure things are sustainable. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to be eating meat, which I do eat meat, but I try to not do it in an overabundance. And I try to, but I think as a society, we absolutely need to be more aware of where we get our meat from. Because I think if more people knew what the animals go through, what many of the animals go through that you're getting at the supermarket, you would not want it to eat it anymore.
And it's maybe even eat less meat, but eat meat where you know it's come from a reputable source. So rather than eat, like, I eat meat. I'm not against eating meat, but I would prefer, rather than eating meat for three meals a day, eat meat once a day or once every 2 days, but get that meat. Pay a little bit more for it, but know where it's come from rather than know where it's come from. And because, like you said, you know, there's some horrendous, especially factory farming, there's some horrendous things that go on there.
I mean, it is literally, the health experts are saying this is literally where we'll get the next pandemic from. The vira and bacteria that are like developing in those poor animals.
Well, this took a fucking downturn, didn't
right?
it?
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, but when I attended the Yule bloats that involved pig slaughter, it was no different than when I was a kid. We would have family get-togethers where there was a pig roast, and it was bought and raised because there was going to be a family gathering the next year, and that was what its purpose was. And then it fed the family. And that was how this was. But there were some people that attended that they weren't from a hunting family. They weren't from a farming family. And it was very meaningful for them because they experienced something of the reality of the world. And it taught them respect. And they said this. And it taught them to respect where they got their meat from. So we got a group of people saying, we're going to do we have a Yule bloat. We have the means to do it. So we're going to do an animal set. We're going to use a pig. And we're going to do it in this kind of a setting. But then you end up with a very modern reception of that, right? People today who are from a suburban background are now being introduced to, oh yeah, this is what animals go through when we eat. Well, that taught me something, and that taught me more to respect animals more and nature more. This is not something that would have happened 1,000 years ago. They would not have been like, oh wow, well, we should respect animals more. You know, that's not what would have happened during the Plague. No. That's what's happening today. So,
true. Yeah. Absolutely.
If so to end on a light note, I guess I can share that I don't know if it's particularly extraordinary or anything like that, but the way that I celebrate Yule is that on the day of the solstice, I greet the sun in the morning on a mound not so far from here. So so I don't know if that's extraordinary or anything like that, but that's my personal little thing. Climb a mountain and then say hi to the sun. And
I do too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I actually do too. I have a song that's all composed and I sing it for the sun when it rises. That's funny.
We do the same thing.
Yeah. I was going to say for me, I guess it was last year's Yule when I went to Sean Parry's cave party and had a little bit too much mead to drink, decided to go out and have a wee, fall and crack my head open on some rocks in a Welsh cave, and come to maybe 2 hours later in A&E with 13 stitches in my forehead. So that was a fun one.
That's another way to do sacrifice, I guess.
For sure. Well, yeah, almost was.
It's also very like Yingling saga. Like, he got really drunk at the Yule celebration and then died.
Yes, that it almost was.
At least he didn't drown in like a mead tub or something like that.
Yeah, for sure. Right, let's wrap this up. I'm quite hungry.
Yeah.
Now we've spoken about all this food, all this meat. So, Matthias, any plugs you want to shout out?
Well, you can always find me on Instagram by my name, Matthias Nordvik. You can find the Nordic Mythology channel on Facebook, where I do my best to remember to upload, podcast episodes and stuff like that. Sometimes I forget. And yeah, always check out my website, NordicMythologyChannel.com. And yeah.
Awesome. So yeah, like we said at the top of the show, obviously these every video episode we've done, the full back catalogue is all going to be available. Me and Matthias are going to have a word after the show and we'll figure out where exactly we're going to put those videos. All future episodes, the videos will become available to the public after 1 month after the audio is released. Obviously, that first month is just for patrons only. The new feature that we've added for Patreon, people who support us on Patreon, is that you can now join in and watch the episodes live. You can also join in the live chat, ask us questions during the show, and it make it a little bit more interactive. If you like the show, please take a moment after the show, leave us a 5-star review and a positive rating. It really helps us kind of find new audiences. Hit the subscribe button so you know when things come out. If you want to follow me, obviously it's Daniel_Farrand1 on Instagram or at Horns of Odin. And I think that's probably about it.
I got one last thing.
Oh, yeah, sure.
If you were to follow the old lunisolar calendar, the supposed Yule moon is the full moon. That's when we or many various researchers, particularly Andres Nordberg and myself as well, believe that they would have done. This is when the festivals would have been, the Yule drinking and the sacrifices. That will be January 27th, 28th, and 29th. So if you want to splatter blood all over your house and go get drunk in the snow and do other unholy things for Yule, that's the time to do it.
There we go. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Josh. It's been fun as always. Yeah. And
thanks for having me.
We have some. We spoke before the show about some topics we're going to cover next time.
Thanks, guys.